Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Dr. Pamela Davis, Professor of General Medical Sciences at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine and member of the Board of Directors for the Clinical Research Forum.
Currently serving as Dean of the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, Dr. Davis is a holder of 7 U.S. patents and is a founding scientist of Copernicus Therapeutics, a biotech company that creates novel pharmaceutical targeting and delivery systems. Throughout her career, she has served in prominent roles such as the Advisory Council to the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, the Board of Scientific Counselors for the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and the Advisory Council for the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. So on today's episode, we'll be discussing specific topics around the Clinical Research Forum, as well as the clinical research industry and Dr. Davis's own career. So thank you for joining us today, Dr. Davis.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Yes, thank you again, Dr. Davis. First question that I want to get into is, can you tell us a little bit more about the Clinical Research Forum and your role on the Board of Directors?
Well, the Clinical Research Forum was founded in 1996 to advance and support clinical research. The members are mostly institutions with a big stake in clinical research, but we have some corporate members, particularly in the IT sector, and some pharmaceutical members as well. And we strive to support clinical research in its many forms. We have advocated within academia for the stature of clinical research within the institutions and around the country. And we have also striven to improve the process and conduct of clinical research, making it more streamlined, making it faster to get new discoveries to patients. These include advocacy at the government level for funding and appropriate regulation. We sponsor an annual IT roundtable to look at the interaction of particularly academic clinical research with informatics, the electronic health record, and other electronic technology that bears on clinical research. We've tried to strive to connect the industry, IT, voluntary health organizations, which are very important constituents in clinical research. And we have most recently been focusing on broadly engaged team science, the concept of team science to begin with as recognizable as an academic good, broadly engaged team science that brings in the community, minority representation in clinical research, both for researchers and for participants in clinical research and women in clinical research. And one of our big activities is acknowledging excellence in clinical research by naming every year the top 10 clinical research papers that have been published that year. And we've been very excited about this because there's just a dramatic increase in the quality and the importance of the clinical research that's being published. I've been on the board since 2012. My institution developed a CTSA, which is a major grant from the NIH, from the National Center for Advancing Translational Science. In our institution, my Case Western Reserve got one in 2007. I was the first PI, and now we're on our third PI and multiple changes that the NIH has made in these grants. But that was my initial connection to being on the board. I have worked on broadly engaged team science. I've worked on the minority white paper, the white paper on the inclusion of minority faculty and participants. And most recently, I headed the Academic Advancement Committee, which put together the paper that was published in Nature Medicine on the impact of the COVID pandemic on female clinical researchers.
For our next question, we kind of started getting into this before we started recording off air, but there seems to be a bit of a divide of clinical research conducted within government and academia versus the industry or the pharma sponsor side, and some even call it the dark side. Would you say this is an accurate portrayal?
Well, my background, my personal background is in research in cystic fibrosis. So I may be colored by what I learned in the cystic fibrosis world. And I look at research as a broad continuum, and clinical research is a broad continuum between the academic and the pharmacy sponsored, pharmacotherapeutics organization sponsored research. In cystic fibrosis, the CF Foundation was prescient and visionary in supporting industry. And honestly, most of the big way the cystic fibrosis population isn't big enough to attract the heavy hitters in pharma. So it's mostly mid-size and smaller pharmaceuticals. And the CF Foundation invested in companies to help develop drugs that would be beneficial to patients with CF. And one of the advantages of doing that was that these companies then conducted the clinical trials, but they did it in partnership with academia. And cystic fibrosis patients are collected in centers that sit in academia and did a lot together to bring cystic fibrosis from a disease when it was first described in 1938, when you were dead before you were one, to a disease now where the calculated projected life expectancy is 50 and headed upward on a rocket course because we now have drugs that address the basic defect. So I'm very much a believer in the continuum of clinical research. I also think that a lot of discoveries come from academia, and they are going nowhere if they don't go through the private sector. They must be handled and developed for patient use in the private sector. And honestly, for diseases that tend to get collected in academic centers, I think the pharmaceutical industry needs academia, and they need the advice of people who spend a lot of time thinking about the strategies and streamlining of patient-based research. I think in the best of cases, it's a partnership.
Back to the CR form for a moment. How does the CR form influence how industry-supported clinical trials are conducted?
Well, I think one of the things that we've tried to do is we realize that when we started in 1996, clinical trials were cumbersome and slow. And we've been trying to advocate for and make suggestions on streamlining the process. For example, mutual acceptance of IRB approvals at various academic centers has been important. Common IRBs has been important. We have advocated for a high-level ethical conduct of research, and that helps industry tremendously because they need to be above the fray. They need to be sure that every one of their trials is conducted in an ethically appropriate way. We've also advocated for and provided strategies for expanding the pool of participants in patient-based research. And it's very, very important for industry to have a representative group of patients who are enrolled in their clinical trials, so that the results can be generalized to these groups. So I think we've done a lot of things that impact industry. And as I mentioned before, the Clinical Research Forum tries to place industry and academics in the same panels in the same room to talk about what the various needs are and what we should be doing and what we should be advocating for. So I think that there's a lot of influence that the Forum has had on streamlining and improving clinical trials that has a very positive impact on industry.
Those are really good points, Dr. Davis. I was just thinking we used to cover how academic research centers were addressing those same issues, as you mentioned, IRB, and kind of centralizing their research, their clinical trials as a business, to attract more industry. And I'm just wondering what you feel like the relationship between academia and industry is right now. I know that you mentioned that clearly it's a continuum, but do you feel that there's more collegial interaction, that there's more collaboration, I guess?
Yeah, I think that there is more intellectual exchange for sure. And I do think that some of the efforts that have been made in academic centers to improve the conduct of clinical trials have been well received by industry. I think that industry is still concerned about the cost of doing things in academic centers. And as a former dean, I'm not sure I know how to fix that entirely. because we are obliged in academia to maintain the government mandated offices and programs that maybe industry isn't too concerned about. And I'll give you one small example. I would say 10 years ago, I didn't know what export controls were. And by the time I stepped down as dean in 2020, I had a lawyer and a half working on export controls, which was required by the federal government and was basically an unfunded mandate. So there are a lot of things that have to be done in an academic center that takes government money that may not seem to be important to industry. On the other hand, when the world situation crashes, as it is right now, the notion that we are protected by those sorts of export controls may be important for industry too. So I know that academia is costly, but you know, we're not parking Cadillacs in the hallway. You know.
Yeah, it's human lives, right? And it's human.
Yes.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So let's get into the paper now. Can you provide an overview of the author's call to action in that paper you mentioned that was published in Nature Medicine?
Thank you. We were struck by the fact that although women had been making very slow incremental gains in academic medicine, the COVID-19 pandemic had just pushed those gains back. And even in the short period of time since the pandemic started, there was great evidence that women were impacted, especially women with young children, were impacted far and above men. They were not able to spend the time on research. They were not able to spend the time at work, let alone at research. And this was reflected by fewer papers, grant applications for less money, and the loss of the attrition of women, particularly at the cusp of promotion and moving into the senior ranks, particularly the loss from the academic pipeline. And we sat and our committee sat and tried to make a series of recommendations. And of course, some of them involve money, because if you have more people who are able to work for you, you're able to do more. So our first recommendations were really that, in part because women don't get the recruitment packages at the same level as men do in academic medicine, we needed the academic institutions to step up and provide short-term and flexible support. We recommended $50,000 to $75,000 a year for a couple of years for those who are heavily impacted by caregiving responsibilities. Now, it's interesting that we weren't the original thinkers of this. The Doris Duke Charitable Foundation developed a fund to retain clinical scientists, and they were able to attract other voluntary health organizations and foundations like the Burroughs Welcome Fund, Rita Allen, the Walder Foundation, and I think the American Heart Association as well, to provide competitive grants to the institutions to do this. So I think getting enough help at the institutional level is important. We also thought that the institutions needed to step up and try to assist the women in getting appropriate childcare and elder care mechanisms. Now, the data are out there mostly on childcare, but my personal experiences are that there are a number of women who were really slammed by the need to care for elderly parents, because at least in our area, the assisted living facilities stopped taking new patients and new residents. And it's almost impossible to get a home caregiver if you didn't have one before. So that put a burden on, I know at least one very talented woman who withdrew her application for a vice dean position because she couldn't find care for her mother and she didn't think she could handle those responsibilities. So I think that because those things tend to fall to women, I think we should remember that. We also needed to remind people that the culture needs to expect that gender equity will occur, and it's a shared responsibility. It's not just the responsibility of the leaders, though we thought you have to incorporate it into criteria for merit raises and bonuses for the institutional leaders. But we also felt we needed to engage boards of trustees. It needs to come from the very top. and they need to make it a priority for university presidents and hospital presidents. And it will, in that way, trickle down. Now, we think the usual things need to be done, you know, that women need the high quality mentorship and the appropriate training programs. But one of the things that the pandemic has done is reveal that flexible work schedules are in fact workable, and that the use of technology, both for communications and for some activities such as telehealth visits, can work. And those have made life much more flexible for many women. You don't have to spend a half an hour commuting in, a half an hour commuting back. That's time that can be devoted toward your academic activities. We also wanted to encourage and congratulate the foundations and individual philanthropic donors who develop programs to try to protect women in these circumstances. And we wanted to congratulate the NIH, which did institute some important federal programs to support childcare for rising investigators. We also wanted to endorse the concept for society that childcare and elder care are valuable national infrastructure. And if we stop thinking of them as it's the woman's responsibility to figure out how to do this and start thinking of it as a societal responsibility, I think we'll be farther along. And we want to celebrate the people who are in the organizations who've really stepped up and done this. So like the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, like some of our institutions that have put forward excellent childcare and elder care facilities of their own. And we would like to be able to do that. So we had a lot of things that we thought were a menu of possible interventions, but we also recognize that there may be other very creative ways to do this. And we encourage people to think about how they would like to do it.
That's very inspiring, you know, having that creative thought process to address some of these systemic societal issues. And the elder care piece is something that we haven't talked too much about in the pharmaceutical space. Definitely the childcare kind of piece, but I wanted to just observe that the themes that you just discussed, as well as for the article that you and your colleague, Dr. Wu, wrote for Applied Clinical Trials, we do talk about an industry. So some of them are advancing women to the executive levels, making sure that there's mentorship and a pathway for them to, you know, get there, as well as to include female investigators to increase participants, you know, because the participants identify with the doctor, the investigator. So I just wonder if there's a way that academia and industry could help each other in advancing women in research. I mean, I heard some things in what you were saying your paper called for, but just from your point of view.
Yeah, well, I think that academia could look at the data that's been gathered in industry. And I think there's good data in industry that having women on the board of directors and in the C-suite makes companies more profitable.
Right.
And I think that the analogies can be drawn with what goes on in academia. And we should be taking a lesson from that. I think you all have learned in industry that women in high-level positions improve the engagement of women all through the programs, and that's very important. So I think that's a big deal. And in the paper that Dr. Wu and I produced for you, you see the impact of not including women in clinical trials. I think 8 of the 10 drugs that were withdrawn by the FDA, which with a lot of fanfare, were withdrawn because of the negative impact on adverse effects on women. So if you knew that at the beginning, you could have done a whole lot better in both rolling it out and in labeling the drug. So I think those are very important things for academia to learn. Academia, in particular academic medicine, has been slow on some of these things. It has not moved as rapidly. We're not as nimble as industry, but maybe we're also a little bit stodgier too. So I think that there's a lot to be learned here. And I think that one of the things that industry can do is actually require that participants in clinical trials be distributed as the population that the drug is intended for is. So if you intend to give it to both men and women, you better enroll 45 to 55% women. And that should be something that is incorporated into the requirements of a clinical trial. And just as the same we've learned with minority populations as well, that if you give lip service to it, but you don't put some requirements in it, it isn't going to happen as rapidly. And industry has a great deal of power in that way.
So to close, Dr. Davis, you have been an accomplished female leader in academia and medicine and research. So can you share some examples of advances that you think have been made for women in those areas?
Well, I'm proud to say that there are fewer firsts these days for women because a lot of barriers have been broken. I was the first, and at that time, the only female MD-PhD student in the Duke program when I enrolled in that MSTP program. And now the MST program, at least at Case Western Reserve, is about half women. Mm-hmm. So there has certainly been a sea change in the admission of women to medical schools and to high-powered research programs. When I first was enrolled to my medical school class, there were 8 women out of 88 members of the class.
Wow.
I believe our class now is 52% women, and I believe that's the number for nationwide as well. So I think there are things that are changing. I think women, and particularly young women, put up with less grief than we did decades ago. I can remember approaching my chief resident when I was a resident about an inappropriate approach from an older faculty member. And he said, oh, that's just easy, Ed. He's harmless. Learn to duck. And nowadays, that complaint would really be taken seriously. And I think things have changed. And I think the atmosphere there has changed. I think there's more acknowledgement of work-life balance. I mean, when I went through residency, there were no limits on work hours. And now there are. 80 hours sounds like an awfully long week. On the other hand, I don't think I ever added up the number of hours a week that we used to work as residents. So there is something of a nod to that. And there is more of an approach in medicine of the group practice so that it isn't just the lone doctor who has to answer all the calls from his or her entire patient panel. You know, unfortunately, women are still relatively rare at the high levels in medicine. We are only about 18% of deans now, and we lag other professions. For example, law has been steadily increasing the number of women deans, and I believe they're over 25% now. We certainly got 52% in the pipeline. What would we like to see in the upper levels? If there are analogies to improving the profitability of a company with women in the C-suite, shouldn't we be thinking a little bit more about that?
Definitely. Those are all good points. And I appreciate you sharing, you know, your experiences. I just learned so much, and I so appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Davis.
Had limitless access to customer insights, accelerated timelines, and set fees. At True Serum Network, we're fueled by connections in virtually every area of healthcare as part of MJH Life Sciences. The result? Audience-fed creative and more powerful content in less time. True Serum Network, releasing what's real. Find out more at TrueSerumNTWK.com.